edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the publisher and editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. Passwords to protect sensitive accounts on computers are almost as old as computers themselves. But unlike the systems they protect, passwords haven't really changed much in the last 50 years. But the need for passwords to secure sensitive systems and accounts has grown by leaps and bounds during that time. But this creates a conundrum as we all struggle to manage more and more sets of supposedly unique credentials. Simply put, the more secure the password, the harder it is to remember, and the easier a password is to remember, the less secure it is. Many security experts and leading technology firms are of the opinion that traditional passwords have passed their sell-by date. More and more applications and services offer users so-called two-factor authentication. Firms like Apple have introduced biometric authentication tools like fingerprint readers. And just this week, Microsoft added a feature to its Authenticator app that allows users to sign into their Microsoft account without having to enter the password at all. What's the future of the password and what will replace it? To answer that, we sat down with Robert Capps, who's the Vice President of Business Development at the firm New Data Security, which helps companies spot sophisticated and unsophisticated attempts to take over user accounts. Robert said he's no fan of passwords, but he isn't convinced that the world will do away with them anytime soon. Instead, he said, companies need to get better at spotting the actions of fraudulent actors, including scams like the creation of synthetic identities that combine stolen and fictional data as a way to defraud banks and online merchants. I started our conversation by asking Robert where it is that online fraudsters are able to obtain passwords or other information they need to impersonate users and take over sensitive accounts.
Yeah. So, one needs to only look at the media headlines over the last 12, 18 months, or even going back 5 or 6 years. Some major corporations have had data breaches that have resulted in the spill of consumer data. Things like name and address and phone number and email address are often provided by consumers on non-financial, non-retail sites. You sign up for a newsletter, you probably provided a username and password, the username probably being your email address. If you signed up for, or you purchased a product online, you've given your shipping address, you've given your credit card number. If you've filed taxes or with an online tax preparer or even a physical in-person tax preparer, you provided income information, so security numbers and other sorts of things. So, the variety of data points out there that are being breached, the common ones, name, address, phone number, dates of birth, secret questions like mother's maiden name, those are all things that many websites ask for, and consumers dutifully comply and provide those data points in order to get some value from the company they're trying to interact with. As you get to more sensitive information, one needs to only look back to financial services break-ins, data processor break-ins, those sorts of companies that process the sensitive data, there have been attacks against their databases. Payroll systems contain a lot of this data, and we've seen attacks against payroll systems at large corporations. The data is out there, and if it's useful to an attacker, they're going to find a way to get it.
And when we're talking about synthetic identities, what generally are we talking about? That's kind of sci-fi sounding term, but I think it's actually a lot more mundane. So explain to us what we mean by synthetic identity.
Yeah, so synthetic identity really refers back to the practice that fraudsters and cyber criminals have adopted of late, where they take either a random smattering of data or they take pieces from multiple actual human identities from data breaches, and they put them together into a new identity. So they might take my name, they might take your address, they might take someone else's phone number, they might make up a social security number if that's even required, and they'll start using that identity in a number of places. And what happens with that is those identities actually take on a life of their own as they tend to interact with multiple companies. So taking that newly created identity and registering it for an online purchase or something with a prepaid, like a gift card, you can start to get that information entered into public and private databases that are often resold and used for fraud remediation. Looking at the longevity and viability of this new profile, by not using an actual human's data, the likelihood that the actual owner of the information will step up and realize that their information is being used, without using that, the likelihood of being caught is very, very low. And so what ends up happening is the fraudsters are now creating these identities, so that there's no actual human to tip off, and so their scams run a lot longer. We're starting to even see things like bank accounts being opened in these in synthetic, you know, the names of these synthetic identities, where before, if someone went and opened a bank account in my name with my social, my date of birth, the chances are I'd find that very quickly.
So this synthetic identity, would it have the same name as you, or same social security number, but different name, and therefore it's not going to trigger an alarm?
The idea here is to be able to, it isn't about me or my identity. It's just about taking data points and putting them together to create a new identity
right. That
can then grow legs and be used across a number of different properties to commit fraud. And the thing is, because there's no credit report that's being reported to under my name, or to my social or those sort of things, what ends up happening is that these fraud schemes tend to run a little bit longer. This is a direct response to the anti-fraud techniques that have been in place at most retailers and financial institutions looking for inappropriate use of someone else's identity. They weren't necessarily looking for an aggregated use of multiple identities in one transaction. And so it's taken some of the institutions a little more time to adjust to this, and it's given the opportunity to the fraudsters to be able to use this sort of technique to basically increase their gain on the fraudulent schemes.
So if you have as many of us do now, credit monitoring, identity theft protection monitoring service, these types of scams may or may not show up. Is that what you're saying?
So depending on the complexity of the identity verification techniques, they may not be set up to be able to identify and vet an identity that doesn't really exist in the real world. It's a really hard problem to solve for most organizations, because they tend to rely on public and private databases to vet data. And if you use an identity properly a few times, you're likely to be in those databases, and it makes it easier to commit those attacks for a little while. Eventually, some high-profile losses will happen, and I'll get tagged with the identity, and the identity will be discarded by the fraudsters. But it gives them a lot more leeway than, say, using my entire data set to commit fraud, and someone looking me up in a database somewhere and you know, like a retailer, and calling me and saying, hey, did you just order 10 large-screen TVs? That'll get caught pretty quickly. And using a synthetic identity, that isn't necessarily the case. That fraud could go on for quite some time until the chargebacks start rolling in.
So you said that you guys use a variety of different detection methods, from observing how a particular entity interacts with a web page, trying to figure out if it's some kind of automated script or an actual human, some kind of fingerprinting of the device they're using, and I would assume maybe where they're connecting from, and those types of questions. How accurate is it, and what is the follow-through? So after you've flagged a particular interaction as suspicious, what do you do then, especially given that obviously companies that are doing business online are very concerned about false positives and certainly don't want to lose a sale over this. So what do you do then?
First and foremost, the thing that you want to look at is account creations. So when this account is being created, when the data is being used for the first time, in order to get an identity to the point where it's going to be trusted, you've got to start registering it with a large number of websites. And you're not going to have a human sitting there entering data on every website. What they're probably going to use is they're going to load up a database of synthetic identities. And they're going to use a computerized script to then go out and register those identities at different web properties and start interacting with those. And so first and foremost, if you can identify those interactions on your registration flow that are automated, you have a high likelihood of identifying the most risky registrations that are being placed. And so you have a much higher probability of catching and disrupting those sorts of registrations. It helps by stopping that automated activity. When we start looking at things like synthetic identity, it's a slightly different problem set than account takeover, in that we're trying to identify patterns of behavior that exist for a good consumer. And so for our customers, where they're looking at that revisiting user, a lot of these fraudsters are going to share these accounts across multiple humans when they actually do commit fraud. And so we can look and see whether or not we believe the same human's coming back time and time again, and we can flag when there's a shifting of people time and time again.
What are the industries that are most affected by this type of scam?
We see heavy adoption in the retail sector to combat retail fraud. We see heavy adoption in the financial services sector to combat account takeover and related fraud. in the service provider business, especially around things like free online services, gaming, things like that, account registration fraud, where automation is used to create large volumes of fake accounts and things like that. You know, even in the review space where you have product reviews and things like that, you have large volume automation that goes out and creates lots of accounts in order to submit fake reviews and to flood sites and to make products, you know, more or less attractive to consumers. So there's a lot of different ways that the intelligence we provide to our customers can be used to make customer experience better.
You know, there's been a lot of focus in the media on the problems with passwords. People have too many of them. People tend to have bad password hygiene, or they forget them, or they reuse them. You know, people saying, well, we need to move beyond the password. The password is dead. You're a little bit of a skeptic about the password is dead. Talk to me. What do you see as the role of the traditional static, you know, alphanumeric password? And where do you think things are going?
I think the password's useful life is long past. We just haven't innovated as an industry to replace it with something that isn't just chewing gum and duct tape, that just replaces the password with some other static variable that just happens to be managed in a different way. I'm a huge proponent of the industry really taking a solid look at how do we solve this problem for forever. And one of the problems that we have on the internet is that we have actually every time we have a different website, we have a different identity broker in play, right? So every company has decided to be their own identity broker to allow self-registration and consumer submitted information for registration, and not a lot of the ability to vet who those people are. At the end of the day, we need some trusted identity brokers to be able to identify when the right humans are using the right information to register accounts and interact with them. And I think that is the first step to solving the username and password problem, is creating vetted identities. And from there, doing strong enrollment of some additional identification technologies to allow for strong authentication. So we see the benefits of physical and passive biometrics are great. But right now, we still see all of those enrollments happening at the individual website level or individual company level, which is negating a lot of the benefits we would necessarily see from centralized authentication systems. That being the case, we are in a very, very capitalistic society, and everybody wants to be that registry because there's great money to be made at. No one, you've got Google that wants to be the authenticator, you have Facebook that wants to be the authenticator, you've got all these companies that have, grand designs of being the authenticator, and they're fighting out in the marketplace. And we don't have anyone that's actually standing up and being that authenticator. Everybody has a sliver of the population.
Right. It's like owning the utility and the monopoly board. You know, I mean, it's there aren't that many of them, and it's a huge value.
Right. But you can only run cables so far to your customers. You can't really own everything. And that's really what we found with authentication online. And so, fundamentally, it's an innovation problem. But it's really underlined by a fragmented authentication framework that's caused these problems. And so, you've got products that are continuing to fill the gap to make these frameworks that we have today that do work, they're just not optimal, to make them work better and give us the opportunity to find something that's even better to supplant all of them. It's going to take a concerted industry effort to do that.
Out at RSA, there was the company that won the Innovation Sandbox this year was a company that does passive identity. So aggregating a whole bunch of data from your phone and your movements and so on to forge a very unique identity indicator. Is that kind of where things might be going?
That's a possibility. I did see that at RSA. I know that is close on the heels of Google almost shuttering their own efforts in that space because of the consumer backlash from privacy and other sort of issues.
Creepy.
I mean, it can be depending on how you form up the solution. It was neat. I do know from our own experience, NuData has been around for 10 plus years. And we've got a lot of R&D and intellectual property behind the solutions we have. This is not an easy problem to solve, the passive identification problem. They've done some really neat things and they have some promising technology, but they've got to take it to market and they've got to be able to scale it up. And the number of data points that are being calculated and the speed at which those calculations have to occur becomes limiting factors for technologies like these. And in a lot of cases, they still fall back to some level of username and password in order to enroll that device in your account identity as well.
Yeah.
And so we come back to the challenge of how do you enroll onboard a new device into your account so that a bad guy isn't doing it and training that device and that data to be like you.
There does seem to be an inherent tension as we're moving into this sort of Internet of Things between all of the things that we want to connect and Internet enable for convenience sake and the trade-off in terms of security. So we're happy to have our microwave or our home heating system be internet connected so we can interact with it from afar. But we actually really don't want to have to authenticate to our microwave. And we really don't want to deal with the fallout when we try to authenticate to our microwave and we fail to, and now we're dead in the water and can't use our microwave.
But here's the thing, some things don't require authentication. Some things don't require authentication. I really don't need to authenticate my fridge to open the door. It's physically in my house. It's locked inside my house. Those sort of things, physical proximity and access really, really matter in those cases. But does my refrigerator need the ability to run so many apps that it can now be used as a jumping off point inside my network to transact with my bank unbeknownst to me from my home IP? That gets really scary. And we've got industrial designers who are really good at making sure the refrigerator stays at a perfect 38 degrees that are now designing internet-connected systems with no security built into them at all. We've seen, attacks with malware against IoT devices. That scares me. Someone that builds a refrigerator is really more worried about the refrigerator not fluctuating enough to create spoilage of food that will kill somebody. They're less worried about whether or not that device could be manipulated so that the temperature is brought up in the middle of the night, just enough for the bacteria to build and then dropped again later to poison someone, right? The problem set they're used to dealing with is different than anything else. And, I know I've talked about this publicly before, but, we have underwriters labs and other sort of certification systems in place to verify that appliances are safe, that they're not going to cause a fire, they're not going to cause electrocution hazards, those sort of things. I was at a show last year where UL actually had a booth and they were talking about cybersecurity testing of products. It was like, aha, that's what we need right there. we're going to need to have some certification of these devices that they conform to security frameworks and that they're upgradable in the field. If I've got a ship my fridge back to the manufacturer to get firmware applied so that it no longer is part of a botnet, that's not a real healthy way to deal with it. And so, I think that we're on the right path. There's just so many device manufacturers, both domestically and foreign, and I can buy these devices without having to go through any sort of UL listing or even a local retailer. I can go onto websites right now and I can buy products directly from manufacturers in China that don't necessarily meet the standards that are set for sale of those products here domestically. And so we're starting to see the downside of direct-to-consumer shipment is that we're starting to see those products don't meet the requirements we put on products to be sold in our marketplaces. So it'll resolve itself at some point.
Yeah, where does it go from here? That was going to be my next question.
Well, I think that consumers are going to start asking more questions when their alarm clock stops working because malware has bricked it. We're going to start to see people looking for some level of certification and verification on products, like we saw with fire and electrical safety with Underwriter Labs and other companies like that, or other certification frameworks like that. We're going to see consumers asking for these things or looking for those marks and brandings on packages as we move forward, and they're going to start shopping with their wallet based upon the horror stories they're seeing in the media or things they're seeing posted on Facebook. I think that for the most part, this is a market, the problem that will be solved by market forces and people wanting to buy things that are safe to use within their homes. And so it will self-correct, and I think the problem will be better, especially when we start to have frameworks for certification and testing.
Robert Capps is the VP of Business Development and New Data Security. Robert, thanks for coming on the Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
We were talking with Robert Capps. He's the Vice President of Business Development at the firm New Data Security.